12345 and 021320, State ex rel. Griffin v. Smith, State ex rel. Glenn v. Litcher, arguing for Mr. Griffin and Glenn is Nathaniel Cage. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Attorney Nathaniel Cage, Jr. of Michael, Best, and Friedrich, appearing as the court-appointed counsel for petitioners Micah, Glenn, and Peter Griffin. This matter was referred to this court on a direct appeal from the Wisconsin Court of Appeals because the facts in the consolidated cases are very similar to the facts in Mintec v. Schwartz. In Mintec, James Mintec's probation was revoked after he had the assistance of counsel during the revocation process. After his revocation hearing, Mintec's appointed counsel had agreed to file an appeal on the revocation to the administrator of the Division of Hearings and Appeals. That appeal had to be filed within 10 days of the administrative law judge's decision. 5 days after the deadline, Mintec's appointed counsel wrote him and told Mr. Mintec that he would not file an appeal to the administrator. No reason for not appealing was given. This court, in its majority opinion, did not address the substantive issues of Mintec's appeals for ineffective assistance of counsel. Instead, this court decided Mintec on very narrow grounds. Specifically, the court allowed Mr. Mintec to file a writ of certiorari despite the fact that he did not exhaust his administrative remedies. In a separate concurrence, Chief Justice Abramson adopted the sound reasoning of Judge Richard Brown in Mintec's Court of Appeals case. Because Mintec was decided on very narrow grounds, this court is again faced with an analogous case. Here, Peter Griffin's attorney, James Turan, represented Mr. Griffin during the revocation proceedings and subsequent appeal of the administrative law judge's decision. Attorney Turan also promised to file an appeal on Griffin's behalf and did so, but not within the 45 days required by statute.
Also, let me ask you, in your brief, you're asking for a, we'd say, a bright line rule that you basically have a right to counsel. There's no question, and that seemed to be, you cited the Mintec case and referred to the concurrence. What do you see as a problem with what the state is advocating, which is basically, look, in this case, the attorneys didn't do something allegedly that they promised to do. So in this case and other cases like it, that that there would be an opportunity to have counsel. Why do we want to have a bright line rule when it may affect other issues which have to do with a no merit case, things of that nature? So what is your
Yes, Your Honor. I actually spoke with Mr. Freemuth on the elevator about that issue, and the reason why I think a bright line rule.
That's a good question. Yeah,
it is a very good question.
Show me his answer.
And the reason I think. The reason, Your Honor, I believe a bright line rule is necessary is in this case, the facts, we have both attorneys Turan and Weichman, both admit that they failed to do what they had promised their attorney they were going to, their counsel, their clients they were going to do.
Sure.
That's not always the case, Your Honor, and the problem I see is down the road, if we're constantly faced with these evidentiary hearings where the attorney is saying, well, I told my attorney there could be misunderstandings, miscommunications, you have issues with a number of these prisoners don't necessarily have the mental faculties to be able to say or to understand what the process entails.
Well, then we get into, I mean, I don't want to, I'm just asking because that question seemed to be one that, well, yeah, we could handle this in the way suggested, but you it seems to me, I don't want to say this as an attorney's full crew law, but you get, so everyone will have an attorney, and it affects the probation, parole, and that's in as it is in the first instance when the first, you know, first crime is a person is commits the first crime. It seems to me that they have their liberty interests are different here in one case than in the other.
Well, actually, Your Honor, I disagree. I think the liberty interests are very, very similar, if not the exact same. And the liberty interest is being sentenced for reincarceration. So, for example, if you have someone...
But they're already, they're basically under the state's jurisdiction at this time, right?
Well, there's a difference, Your Honor, between being on probation, having to check in every so often with your probation officer, having a job, being allowed to go home, and then being put back into jail to finish out a sentence. There's a tremendous difference. So, yes, the liberty interest, you can argue it's slightly different, but I would argue that being forced to go back to jail to finish out a sentence, being reincarcerated, is a very strong liberty interest. In fact, it's the exact same.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with that. I'm just saying that their status, they're in a different capacity. That's...
Well, sure. One is a civil commitment hearing, and the other is criminal, but the end result is no difference. You're either going to go back to jail or finish out a sentence, or the court's going to say there's not sufficient evidence to find that there was a violation of whether it's probation, parole, or extended supervision.
Mr. Cade, if I might interrupt and ask you a couple of questions.
Yes.
If Justice Wilcox is finished. You were relying a couple minutes ago on Mentec.
Yes.
And it's my understanding that the issue that was addressed in the concurrence of the Chief Justice and in the earlier dissent at the Court of Appeals level by Judge Brown was a different issue than the issue we have here. In that particular case, as I understand it at least, the right to counsel issue had to do with the administrative hearings. You seem to be taking this one step further now, as I understand your argument, and saying, well, that right to counsel shouldn't stop at the administrative level. It should go on to the writ of certiorari before the circuit court. How do you make that jump? When I look at the administrative code sections, they seem to be talking about the client's rights at the hearing. The administrative hearing, and I understand there's a right to appeal, but again, the administrative code sections talk about appealing to the administrator. So how do you get from there to the idea that you've got this statutory right to counsel at the circuit court level with the writ of certiorari?
Yes, Justice Crooks. I guess what I am relying on more than anything, Your Honor, is Schmelzer versus Murphy, where the court said, quote, read together Wisconsin statutes 809.32.4, which is the no merit position, and 977.05.4 sub J, create a right to counsel in petitions for review and cases before any court, provided that the counsel does not determine the appeal to be without merit. And that was at page 253 of the court's opinion. And so reading that, Your Honor, seems to suggest that as long as the counsel does not file a frivolous appeal, which is really what a petition for cert is, it's an appeal from the ALJ and from the department, as long as it's not frivolous or and they comply with the no merit position, and again, 977 deals with the public defender, and obviously there has to be two requirements, and I concede those requirements have to be met. Under Schmelzer, Your Honor, it says they have a right to counsel before any court. It doesn't make distinguish between Court of Appeals, Supreme Court. It says before any court. So I read that in conjunction with the administrative rules to suggest the right to counsel should be at all stages. Now, I don't think that the right to counsel is going to end up, you're going to have 50 lawyers appealing to this court revocation proceedings. I think a lot of that is going to be dealt with at the circuit court level. And I think that's part of the similar position of doing a no merit. So if you have appointed counsel, once they argue, well, the ALJ made a decision or determination that was erroneous, the standards are really going to rise to petition beyond the circuit court and the petition for review. And if appointed counsel believes it has no merit, they file it. That's the reason why I argued the bright line rule in response to Justice Wilcox's question is, at least in the Seventh Circuit, for example, it happens often, you file the appeal, the notice of appeal, and then you withdraw. And so that way you don't have an issue of a jurisdictional nature. The beauty of the bright line rule is it avoids the client saying, well, I told my attorney to file the appeal, or I told my attorney to do this. We eliminate that, and as a matter of rule, those are filed. If counsel then wants to withdraw, they can do so. New counsel can be appointed, or we have the no merit where they can say, I'm withdrawing for these reasons. Then it's up to the client or the person who's being their liberties being revoked to come forward with specific reasons as to why it's not frivolous.
Well, now, the state takes issue with you also in regard to the no-merit approach, does it not?
It does.
And do you have any response to that other than it just makes an unorderly process to allow the no-merit approach?
Well, what I take issue with is they want to do this on a piecemeal, case-by-case approach, and I just cannot see that being within the court's realm of judicial efficiency. The no-merit appeal, I mean, the beauty of that is the public defender's office already deals with that today. That's part of their of what they're used to dealing with. So it's not as we have to re-educate them on how to handle those issues. It makes it a lot easier because now you're not spending money, you're not having the factual determinations as to what was said. You don't have issues litigating it and doing case by case and deciding, well, your issue makes a little more sense, we're going to appoint counsel for you, but yours is a little more run-of-the-mill, we're not going to appoint counsel for you. If you start to get into that machination, you're already pretty much close to the stage of having a no-merit review anyhow. I mean, that's why I take issue with the state, because I think theirs just, it makes little sense if you're going to look at it from judicial efficiency standpoint.
Counsel, I want to make sure that I understand what you are arguing and what isn't within your argument. Are you arguing that a person has a right to effective assistance of counsel before the circuit court in the cert proceedings?
In a short answer, yes, Justice Bradley. What I'm essentially arguing is you have the right to counsel because, to me, the revocation proceedings is all the way up to this court. So if it's denied at the circuit court level and the appeal is taken and granted, and then taken up to this court and granted, that process, the right to counsel, should run continuously because, to me, that's all part of the same revocation proceeding.
The third argument set forth in your brief advances a bright-line rule for purposes of the timely filing of a petition for writ. I read that as being, and on page 23 of your brief, you say, minimally, comma, we are requesting, and I'm paraphrasing now, we're requesting that there be counsel for allowing the filing of the petition for writ, and that counsel may withdraw thereafter with judicial permission. Now, that's what I understood your position to be. So I need to grasp what you're arguing for. And can you explain that?
Yes, Justice Bradley. And I think that is you have paraphrased it correctly, the position I'm advocating. The bright line rule preserves the jurisdiction. And the reason that's important is, as the state correctly pointed in its response brief, it's not clear whether, if you miss the 45 days, whether it's jurisdictional. It appears to be. But by mandating that counsel file the petition, you don't have any problems with missing the 45-day period. Then after filing the petition, if they think it, and this is assuming they want to withdraw, if they withdraw, at least now their client is aware, my attorney thinks, you know, is moving to withdraw either for a personal reason, or they're moving to withdraw because they think it's frivolous. And if they think it's frivolous, it's going down the route of no merit, similar to Anders and what this court has dealt with before.
Let me ask, if you take the position that you're advocating for the right to counsel for the entire, as you call it, revocation proceeding through the writ of cert in circuit court, I don't understand why you need to emphasize they have a right to counsel in the filing of the writ. Isn't that subsumed in your larger argument?
Yes, if that is, yes, Justice Bradley, that is correct. It is subsumed. If there is a right to counsel, then you have a right to counsel for the entire process.
Is your argument then you have the right to counsel for the minimally for the filing of the writ, but in the alternative, you have the right to counsel throughout the writ procedure in circuit court also? Is this an alternative argument, or is it?
No, I think they mesh together, Justice Bradley, and the reason is the 45-day rule, it eliminates by mandating that counsel file the petition. You know, obviously, unless the client, for whatever reason, waives that right or just, you know, cuts a deal with someone to lessen the time for reincarceration, which they may do, which they often do, the 45-day bright-line rule, though, preserves jurisdiction. If appointed counsel at that point, following along with Schmeltzer, where it says the right to counsel in petitions for review in cases before any court is granted, provided that counsel does not determine the appeal to be without merit. So we're preserving jurisdiction, and that's really the way the Seventh, and I'm advocating it from the Seventh Circuit position, is you preserve jurisdiction, and then if the counsel says, well, I think it's frivolous, we're going to walk away. The problem we have, though, Your Honor, is that the petition for cert review is when the 45-day clock starts. There is no other filing that you can do under the statutes, similar to the Seventh Circuit, where you can file a notice of appeal and then move to withdraw. We don't have that here. If we did, that certainly would be my position, because I think that's a cleaner break. But at least by mandating they file the petition for review, it cuts away from any argument that counsel did not do what they were requested to do. We don't have evidentiary hearings. We don't stick the circuit court. We're trying to figure out all this other stuff, and it's a bright line as to whether that 45-day period was met. They get the decision. They file the appeal. If they think it's frivolous, they move to withdraw. That would stop the clock, and if the court reviews the no merit and says, no, we think that there is merit to this appeal, they would appoint new counsel, just like they would do in the Seventh Circuit. But if reviewing it, they say, you know what, there is no merit to this, that ends the right.
Well, counsel, where do you get this right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Where do you get the right?
The right to counsel?
Yeah. Right to counsel to file the petition, right to counsel to represent in circuit court, and right to counsel to represent here.
Well, Your Honor,
I'm assuming that's your maximum argument.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you don't say it's constitutional, do you?
No.
Okay. So, where does it arise from?
I keep coming back, Your Honor, to the court's decision in Schmeltzer, read together with stats 809.32 sub 4 and 977.05 sub 4J, create a right to counsel in petitions for review and cases before any court. And there was no distinguishment in terms of a direct appeal or appeal as of right.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
To me, the appeal of the revocation decision is really an appeal of right. It's not a collateral attack on the sentence. You have the right to appeal when the state comes in and says, we're going to reincarcerate you or finish the sentence or do anything else. You have a right to appeal that. And under Schmeltzer, it says petitions for review in cases before any court. There was no limitation placed on that.
Counsel, you're dealing, though, with different statutes. Schmeltzer, you keep on talking about any court, but Schmeltzer found the right based on the reading together two statutes, the right to have an attorney file a petition for review after an unsuccessful appeal to the Court of Appeals is set forth arguably in the statute. There's language in 809.30, Rules of Appeal in Criminal Actions, and 809.30 sub 2, it says post-conviction appellate procedure, counsel to continue. And that goes on to state that the counsel shall continue representation by filing a notice. This is intent to pursue post-conviction relief, I guess. But there is authority in the statutes, whether it be for the circuit court, that you have to continue, or whether it's in Schmelzer, reading the two statutes together, which provides statutory authority for the right. What statute do you rely on with regard to this stage of the proceedings, that is, at the end of the administrative review going into the judicial review?
Well, there are two things I rely upon, Justice Bradley. First is WSSTATS 977-05, which is state public defenders, similar to the statute cited in Schmelzer, but I am relying upon, subparagraph 6, which is restrictions, paragraph H. The state public defender may not provide legal services or assign counsel in parole or extended supervision revocation proceedings unless all of the following apply. One, the parolee or person on extended supervision is contesting the revocation of parole or extended supervision. And two, the Department of Corrections seeks to have the parolee or person on extended supervision imprisoned upon the revocation of parole or extended supervision. So right there, the legislature is saying you have the right to counsel during the revocation proceedings. And that's the second part, Your Honor, is I'm relying upon the administrative code HA 2.05, which talks about revocation proceedings. It's not clear what the legislature meant when they said revocation proceedings. You can argue it very limited by meaning it's the right to counsel during the initial hearing, but that was the problem in Mentec and the Court of Appeals was you had some pre-hearing rights, you had some hearing rights, and you had some post-hearing rights. Or you can argue it as I am seeking is revocation is the entire process. If I am on parole and I have the right to appeal the decision from the administrator to the circuit court, and from there I have the right to appeal to the Court of Appeals, and if granted to this court, to me the revocation proceedings last the entire time, not just during the administrative hearing level. That's the distinction. And I grant it, Your Honor, the court can go either way on that. But if I have the right, if I am being revoked and I have the right to appeal all the way up to this court, I should then have the right to counsel under 977-056-H.
Counsel, if that's the case, then your bright-line rule really doesn't make a lot of difference because if counsel decides to withdraw, then another attorney would have to be appointed to finish out the cert review, and another attorney, if that attorney wanted to withdraw, would have to be appointed to do the appeal to the Court of Appeals, which is as a matter of right from a cert review, and then another attorney or the attorney would be required to continue to file the petition for review before this court, correct?
No, Your Honor. Actually, with the no merit, once it is determined that the either the petition for cert has no merit or even to the Court of Appeals has no merit, it stops. It's then up to the prisoner to turn around and tell why the appeal has merit. And if the court reviews that and makes the determination that, yes, counsel is withdrawing, but we think there is merit, then it continues. But that's rare. It happens often in the Seventh Circuit. I've done a number of criminal appeals there, and I've had to file Anders' brief for the very reasons. You know, the quick example is cocaine versus crack versus powder. My client wants me to appeal. Doesn't matter what they want. The case law is well established in every circuit and the Supreme Court that it doesn't matter that there's a disparity in the amount that you're convicted with. So the no merit position stops the right to counsel if it is determined by the court, whichever court is making the review at that time, that the appeal is frivolous.
Okay, so what you're asking us is to have counsel at the cert review, to have a no merit process before the circuit court. If the circuit court decides there's no merit to the appeal, then you're saying there is no right of appellate review for that circuit court decision?
I'm saying it's the exact same thing, Your Honor, that we do for no merit in post-conviction relief. It's the exact same. They've had the right to counsel. Counsel has reviewed it. Counsel has determined it has no merit. Another court has reviewed it. Plus, as part of the no merit position, the court itself is allowing the prisoner to file, if they so desire, briefs or other memoranda to show why it has merit. So they actually are having the ability to be heard. But no, I would say they would not have the right, if the circuit court determines it has no merit, they would not then have the right to have counsel to appeal. They can always appeal on their own and argue the circuit court was incorrect, but they wouldn't have the right to counsel.
I see. Thank you. No merit for the direct appeal is statutory, 809.32. Where do you find the authority for a no merit procedure that you're advancing?
I don't, Your Honor. That is the position that I'm advocating. But what I'm doing is trying to prevent a situation like Mintec again, where we have, you know, people who clearly asked their attorneys to file the appeal and it never got filed. I mean, the problem, the beauty in this case, Your Honor, is at least both attorneys owned up to what they did. That's not always going to be the case, Your Honor. So if we don't adopt some type of bright line or something, this court is going to get Mintec again. I mean, Mintec was not even 3 years ago, and it will happen again. Thank you.
Well, it seems to me that maybe the clearest argument you have, which has its own set of difficulties, is to rely on the administrative code 2.05 and say that F, which the state concedes Brown's dissent and my concurrence, that entitles somebody to a lawyer in an administrative appeal, that section which says you have a right to counsel, and you read it to mean beyond the hearing to an appeal, and you read that, which is F, with I, that talks about appeal referring to subsection 8, except when you read subsection 8, it only, that's an interesting argument, and that's the way you started out. This is all one ball of wax. The code covers the whole ball of wax. It's time to go home.
Yes.
The problem is sub 8, to which reference is made on appeal, deals only with administrative appeal.
That is true, Your Honor, except, again, it keeps coming back to if it's all how you determine what the revocation process is. If you view the revocation process solely as the hearing, that's one aspect. If you review or view revocation as the administrative component, that's another process. Or if you view it as the right to appeal, wherever that right may lead you, that's another process. I am arguing the third. There is no distinction saying that a prisoner does not have the right to appeal the administrator's decision. They clearly have that right under 227.
But in this case, we could hold very narrowly.
That is true. That is true, Your Honor. I'm just.
The prisoner asked for it, that it be filed. Counsel agreed to file it. Counsel didn't, on an extended kind of schmelzer of equity. He now gets a filing that's considered timely. The court doesn't have to go any farther than that, does it?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor. But if it doesn't, then you're going to get Mintec was 2001, so now you're going to be faced with other people. And the problem we're going to have in other cases is you're not going to get counsel owning up to the fact that they didn't do what they were asked to do. I mean, I view that tantamount to a violation of the rules of professional conduct.
I read that in your brief. Okay, well, we might get Griffin, too. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Primeth, Assistant Attorney General, arguing for Judy Smith, the warden, and John Litcher, Secretary, Department of Corrections, and David Schwartz, Administrative Division of Hearings and Appeals. Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I am Assistant Attorney General James Freimuth, representing the respondent state officials in this appeal. The narrow question is, should the two petitioners be allowed to pursue belated cert review of their parole revocations because their attorneys failed to timely file cert petitions? I believe there are three principal considerations this court needs to address, and this is how the state would like the court to hold with respect to them. First, this court should hold that the 45-day filing period for cert petitions for prisoners set forth in the statute 893.375(2) is jurisdictional. In effect, it may not simply be extended for good cause in the circuit court's discretion. Second, contrary to the petitioner's argument, this court should hold that there is no statutory or constitutional right to counsel for cert review. That includes the whole cert review process, including the timely filing of the cert petition. In effect, there could be no ineffective assistance of counsel claims. In conjunction, this court should decline to create a no-merit cert review process. It is not warranted, and in any case, these cases are not the proper vehicle for doing so. These are not no merit. These are not cases where the attorney said there's no merit to a cert petition. These are cases where the attorney said, I admitted we missed the filing deadline. Third, if this court makes these former holdings, it logically would follow that the petitioners would not be entitled to relief. However, these two petitioners, the state believes, may be entitled to pursue belated cert petitions as a matter of equity for two reasons. Until now, the issue of the right to counsel on cert review has not been squarely decided, and these two petitioners were not forewarned that they could not rely on counsel to timely file cert petitions. If, as the state argues, this case firmly establishes that there is no right to counsel on cert review, future petitioners could not rely on uncertainty about such right to obtain equitable relief. Moreover, I'm sorry.
No, I was thinking of opposing counsel's argument. Now, look, here the attorney said, yeah, we kind of goofed up. What about where there's a debate? And it was fully discussed miscommunication. What do you do there?
Originally, in our brief, we suggested a process that would entail an evidentiary hearing in determining whether the counsel promised to or not. As I mentioned to counsel before the argument, and really in fairness to counsel in the court, this is a slight modification of the state's position. I don't think that probably is a good idea, and I think the way to handle it is to give relief to these two petitioners for the reasons that I just mentioned, that they didn't know whether or not they had a right, but then require the Division of Hearings and Appeals, when it issues the notice of the 45-day filing period, to also include in that notice information that says, you may have counsel, but you're not entitled to rely on counsel for timely filing the cert petition. Not only would this case establish the absence of a right to counsel, but for petitioners then, for prisoners, it would indicate to them that if they want to have counsel, that's fine, but they have no right to it and no right to rely on it.
Pursuant to what authority would we impose that obligation on the department?
As a matter of the court's inherent authority to ensure that there's a due process notice, I guess, involved. I mean, we're not, as I understand petitioner's position, we're not talking about a constitutional right. But I think part of the problem here is the gap and the uncertainty about this right to counsel and if it exists or not. And part of the reason the state has taken the position here that these two petitioners should get relief is that they had no way of knowing whether they had a right to counsel or not because the case law hasn't provided that. This court could just decide in this case there's no right to counsel, and that would be the end of it. They wouldn't have to go so far as to provide a notice, and presumably, as in other contexts, the case decision would stand on its own. The prisoners would be informed as a result of the case that they could not rely on counsel. I don't have a better answer as to the source of where you would impose that obligation beyond that.
Mr. Frymuth, let me give you my common sense approach to this and see what you think. it seems as if you are conceding that there is a right to counsel under the administrative code as far as the administrative hearings. Does it really make sense that you say you get right to counsel through the administrative process, but if a circuit court is going to look at whether or not that administrative process was correct, you don't get counsel? You know, the statutory sections that Mr. Cade referred to seem to have some merit in terms of an interpretation that there is indeed the right to counsel for review by the circuit court. And just from a common sense point of view, why would the legislature and the department take the approach you get counsel through the administrative process, you just don't get counsel when you get to the circuit court? Why does that make sense?
First, on the first premise, I would disagree that the statutes provide that. And again, referring to the public defender statute in particular, two things, both the administrative code and the statutes, neither, in the state's view, provides for the right to counsel. With respect to 977.05 sub 6 and subsections H and I, those deal with the public defender's responsibility in revocation matters. Two things about that, those provisions I think are noteworthy and perhaps determinative here. One is that these are restrictive provisions, although they do say that if two conditions are met, which would seem to be met in most revocation cases, namely that the department is seeking to impose imprisonment and the revocation matter is being contested, that then the public defender has to represent them. But the key part of that statute, and I think opposing counsel respectfully misspoke, the language is not revocation proceedings, it's revocation hearings. And I would read that statute very narrowly in saying that the state public defender only has to represent in revocation hearings, which I would read as limited to the administrative process. Now, I can't speak for the public defender's budget or practice to know if they've been, as a matter of routine, following through when they've been representing at final revocation hearings to represent on cert, but my educated guess is that there are not that's not budgeted for and that they are not doing so as a matter of course. But I did not contact to know. With respect to the administrative code, I think it, by its plain language, the two subdivisions, the one dealing with revocation hearing rights and then the sub 8 dealing with the appeal, talk only again about the administrative process. And I'm not aware of any authority that would allow an administrative agency by rulemaking to recognize a right to counsel in judicial proceedings. So for those two reasons, I don't think the statutes provide a right. Beyond that, I think there are sound reasons not to recognize a right, even if there's a debate about what the statutes mean or whether there is any debate about whether due process, the limited due process right that Ganiel recognizes for the revocation hearings, whether that should extend to cert review. First, a prisoner has only a conditional liberty interest in remaining on parole or supervised release. A successful challenge to revocation does not disturb the conviction or sentence. Second, in Wisconsin, the fairness and accuracy of revocation proceedings can readily be presumed from the statutory right to counsel at the final revocation hearing and from the prisoner's opportunity to obtain judicial review of counsel's performance at that hearing on a habeas petition. This is comparable in a way to what's recognized in the regular criminal process where there's a right to counsel on direct appeal, and we cut off that right, or the right is cut off, the courts say, that there is no right to counsel on collateral post-conviction actions, a 974-06 action, for example. In my understanding, that part of the reason for that is because the protection at the direct appeal stage with the right to counsel is enough. A third reason not to recognize a right to counsel. Cert review of revocation decisions is very narrowly limited. Cert review, in effect, is very deferential. It's limited to whether the agency stayed within its jurisdiction, acted according to law, acted arbitrarily, oppressively, or unreasonably, and whether the evidence reasonably allowed for the agency's decision. In effect, only egregious errors will upset revocation decisions. A fourth reason not to recognize the right to counsel. Egregious errors in the administrative process are not apt to go unnoticed, either by a prisoner or a reviewing court, and in a difficult case, a court does have an inherent right to appoint counsel for cert review if it felt it was necessary. A fifth reason. After an unsuccessful administrative appeal, a prisoner is personally informed by the division administrator of the right to cert review, and the 45-day period, unlike the 10-day period that applies for administrative appeal, there's a 45-day period here. Moreover, there is an abundance of Court of Appeals decisions now that recognize tolling propositions so that prisoners aren't left to concerns where the agency has to do something on behalf of the prisoner. Excuse me. That period should be enough to enable prisoners to manage to get a cert petition in timely.
Are the prisoners advised, and does someone have to advise them about the 45 days of the cert petition?
My understanding is that after the ALJ decision, when they're informed of the notice of the administrative appeal, that that notice also includes the 45-day notice to cert review. And if this court were inclined to do so and included an additional sentence in that notice that said you have no right to rely on an attorney to timely file the petition, or there's no right to an attorney for the cert review.
Now, well, let's just talk about that for a minute. You keep saying you have no right to rely. If an attorney says to somebody, I will do it for you, doesn't mean they have to get paid, but I am going to do this for you. Strikes me that, and I say, terrific. I've hired that lawyer, and that lawyer now has me as a client, paying or non-paying. And I have every right to rely on that lawyer, and I have every right to rely that that lawyer will be effective, give me effective assistance of counsel. And that if the lawyer doesn't, the lawyer's liable in malpractice. And that, so I don't know why you keep saying that advise the prisoner that he or she can't rely on a lawyer. If the lawyer agrees to do it, the prisoner has every right to rely on it and demand good service.
It does seem unseemly, and I think in this case the equities favor giving relief. However, I think the question, your analysis begs the question of whether there's an antecedent right to counsel, so that
it's an antecedent. Look, you have a right to counsel if you can get a counsel to do it, right? The court can't bar the counsel except for very good reasons.
True.
All right. So you have a right to counsel. We're not talking about right to counsel. We're talking about a right to appointed counsel at state expense or county expense, right?
True.
Okay. So, I haven't begged the question. He has a right to counsel. The question is, who's going to pay for this attorney?
Well, I guess I'm not understanding. Our position is that there is no right to an appointed attorney for cert review.
If they have an attorney,
then the question becomes, what kind of reliance can they place on that attorney for purposes of that proceeding,
right,
in terms of effectiveness or not?
Right.
And our position is that even though they may have been able to hire an attorney, because they have no right to an appointed attorney, that they're left to, at their own risk, to that attorney doing what they're at their requested to do.
That's right. So they potentially might have a malpractice action.
Correct. And that's, we're suggesting that that would be the avenue, that and the reference to the Office of Attorney Responsibility. That's their remedy. There is not a remedy, we argue, in the criminal action, or in this case, the revocation action.
But you are saying here, give them a remedy.
I'm saying in this particular case, these two individuals should get relief because the determination or the question of the right to counsel has not been clearly decided. So they wouldn't have any reason to necessarily know that they had no right to counsel.
If it's jurisdictional and it's set by the legislature, how can we open it up?
I'm suggesting that that's, and I think that's part of the problem with the original position in the state's brief about having every time that somebody has an attorney, you look to see whether that attorney agreed to do so. I'm just saying in this particular case that it would not be a jurisdictional problem to grant equitable relief where there is a defect, if you will, an uncertainty in the law is the right to counsel and a failure to notify these people that they could not rely on counsel. I think it's just fair as a matter of equity in these cases. And if this case establishes clearly that there is no right to counsel, then there isn't a need further, it seems to me, to have to go case by case and look at whether or not the person happened to have an attorney and that attorney promised to do it or not. The prisoner knows that he or she at his or her own risk is relying on counsel.
It seems to me that everybody agrees that there is no constitutional right to appointed counsel in this situation. That everybody also agrees, and this is an adjustment of the state's prior position as I understand it, that there is essentially a right to appointed counsel conferred by administrative rule at the agency level.
Correct.
For the revocation hearing as well as the administrative appeal of that revocation hearing. That's a correct statement of the state's position now?
That is, although I would add the caveat that the court wouldn't have to decide the Mentec administrative appeal to decide this issue, but I think it makes logical sense that at some point we're saying, where do you cut off that right to counsel?
Right, but that position of the state now is a modification of the state's position in Mentec.
Correct.
Okay. And there is no statutory right to counsel at the administrative agency level. It's a right that's contained in the administrative agency rules, correct?
I believe so, and I don't know if there is anything in the statutes that points to the Department of Corrections or Hearings and Appeals to create those things. I frankly don't know.
As I understand, the position of the petitioners is that that's a right by implication in the SPD statute, by sort of negative implication. It says
right.
That public defenders shall not appoint counsel
right.
For revocation proceedings unless certain circumstances are present. But there isn't any affirmative establishment of a right to appointed counsel for revocation proceedings. That is contained in the administrative agency rules.
That's correct.
Okay.
And I just, if I may, the statute, I think, could be read first to say that just who's going to represent these people at these agency proceedings. The public defender is, based on this language, and the second part is that framed in the negative and framed with the language revocation hearings, that it's a limitation directed at the public defender. Say, you've got to do this, but you only have to do it in the administrative agency.
Right, and that's where I'm going next with
okay.
This line of questioning, that it is the state's position that the administrative agency rules cannot confer a right to appointed counsel for judicial proceedings, for judicial review proceedings emanating from the agency action.
That's our position.
Okay.
My
follow-up question to that is that, as I understand these rules, they apply to probation revocation, parole revocation, and extended supervision revocation under truth in sentencing, correct?
I think so.
And extended supervision revocation, as I understand the recent revisions to that procedure, involves a two-step process, one at the agency and one in court, that the agency... determine whether or not extended supervision will be revoked, but then the defendant is returned to court for essentially a sentencing after revocation,
right.
Although that's not what it's called. Are you familiar with that?
I know what you're saying. I hadn't thought through that to see whether how that might impact on that proceeding. Whether, if I understand where you're going, and I don't mean to preempt you here, is that does the right to counsel extend to that judicial proceeding for extended supervision?
Right.
I hesitate to give you an off-the-cuff answer because I hadn't thought it through. I was convinced, I guess, or confident that there wouldn't be a difference, but I had not thought about that.
And the SPD statute that Mr. Cade is relying on here does refer to revocation proceedings. It doesn't say hearings, as I read it. The administrative agency rule speaks in terms of rights at the hearing, but the SPD statute does more broadly refer to revocation proceedings, which may or may not include this resentencing,
right,
which is going to occur.
You're absolutely
in a certain
right. I may have looked, and I apologize, I may have looked at the former, before they added the extended supervision context to it. That would undercut what I'm saying.
Well, and my concern is that whatever we say here about how far this right to counsel extends has implications, you know, beyond this.
Absolutely. And I apologize that I did not recognize that.
So what do we do with that? Because there is somewhere in your brief where you, in passing, indicate that this covers all three, probate, even though the case would be correctly postured parolees, although the certified question said probation. But you said, although correctly postured parolees, the same analysis applies to probation revocation and extended supervision revocation. And I think now we have a can of worms.
Right. I think there's a problem with that. And the best answer I can give you is, because I'm sorry, I hadn't recognized it. Best I could do would be to do supplemental briefing on that particular aspect and think it through rather than giving you a quick response to it here. There may be some distinctions with respect to extended supervision. I'm trying to think here what they might be that would make a difference.
Well, it's still a conditional liberty interest.
That's true.
And so the constitutional analysis would probably not be any different. But in any event, it's not this case. We know that. But
right.
The decision here may have implications for that.
That's correct.
Arena.
I guess I would ask for the opportunity to think about that. And again, I apologize for not recognizing that.
It's brand new.
Excuse me?
It's brand new.
Yes. So. But I thought I was hoping to at least encompass also the new world of truth in sentencing. I guess I'm hopeful that there are some distinctions there or some rationale that would support the proposition that we're articulating here that would extend to that. But as I say, I think in fairness to everybody, without really thinking it through, I don't have a real good answer for that.
H talks about extended supervision. H.
Yes, that's what Justice Sykes was pointing out, right.
And that. Well, why do we have to do that? We're not dealing with TIS, not dealing with any of that. We're dealing with a case that's pre-TIS.
That's true.
Not affected by TIS.
This case could be decided without reaching that question. There's a risk that, or a concern that it would be used one way or the other, excuse me, in the extended supervision context. But, excuse me, but again, I would say that you could decide this case without having to wrestle with that question right now.
It seems as though that question may touch upon how you define the phrase probation revocation proceedings that's set forth in 977.06 H. H or I?
056.
Okay.
One is for parole and one is for probation.
Yes.
It's both.
Probation revocation proceedings or parole revocation proceedings. But the question of extended supervision might touch upon how you define that phrase. But let me advance that the way that you decide this case also, I think, touches upon how you interpret and define that phrase. Your opposing counsel seems to be in large part resting the statutory authority on this very definition. Because let me say that maybe the argument for the authority found in the regulation is a little less convincing.
True.
The 205 sub 5 rights and sub 8 appeal, there's a problem with sub 8. But this has potential, depending on how you define parole revocation proceedings. And so I don't know how you can define it for purposes of this case without in some way affecting the definition in reality. I mean, we can say we need not address, but I don't know if you can intellectually do that. If the whole question before us is how do you define it?
Right. I agree that there, the way that language is written, proceedings could be construed to mean beyond the administrative process to include cert review. I guess the argument, again, without having looked specifically at the extended supervision two-part process, is that the same concerns that apply or that were addressed by the state with respect in the pre-truth and sentencing concern as to whether, excuse me, got a cold, as to why there is no statutory right to counsel would apply also with respect to defining proceedings, the word proceedings.
Well, as a matter of practical reality, the State Public Defender's Office does continue to represent probationers who are revoked on withheld sentences through that sentencing after revocation stage. Oftentimes there's an imposed and stayed sentence, in which case return to court is not necessary, but where there's a withheld sentence, in my experience anyway, the SPD who represented the defendant at the revocation hearing appears in court to argue that sentencing after revocation.
Right. There's a different one problem that you just identified is that where there has probation with a withheld sentence and then they go back, then you're in a little different equities, I guess, than just the pure revocation or the probation parole revocation, where the sentence is already imposed and you're just talking about where you're going to serve the rest of it. Probation revocation, where you've got an imposed sentence, so there's really nothing more to do in terms of the sentence. Again, it's just where you're going to be. But where you're talking about a withheld sentence and you're going back for sentencing, perhaps the dynamic becomes a little more important, considerably, or a little more important to the prisoner. I guess if this court were inclined to recognize a statutory right to counsel, then there are other questions that's going to open up. I mean, the budgetary issue of the public defender's budget is one, but the question of is there going to be a right to effective assistance of counsel in the cert review process in the circuit court. In other words, if the attorney files a bad cert petition, is there going to be relief? I think you're also going to run into the question that opposing counsel identified with the no merit situation, and that is there a right to have an attorney always file a cert petition on the merits, or does the attorney have an ethical duty to say, no, I'm not going to do it because it would be frivolous and meritless? And in that situation, how are you going to preserve that right, unless you do start talking about a no merit process of some kind?
On no merits.
Yes.
Doesn't the attorney file a notice of appeal so that time is preserved?
Yes.
Then file a no merit, and then if the defendant wants to file his or her own materials, he or she does. So here the right is preserved by filing the petition. You file a no merit, and then it's up to the client to decide what he or she wants to do.
You could do a no merit process similar to the direct appeal process, where you have first the notice of appeal, the no merit. But then you've got a process in the regular no merit where the petitioner or the prisoner can respond to that. But all this then would have to be in a new timeline situation where I don't think this really can be encompassed within the 45-day jurisdictional timeline that we have.
Well, it can be filed. The petition isn't that difficult, is it? The file.
So, in other words, either a no merit or a merit petition would have to be filed within 45 days?
File the petition, you then say you're going to file your report on no merit. Then you file it. You don't file the no merit report precisely with the notice of appeal, do you?
I'm not I think not, but I'm not positive.
Not too. Yeah. I don't want to be thick, counsel, but in a regular criminal case, you don't hire. Defendant doesn't hire the public defender, hires his or her own counsel, pays for it himself. Counsel is defective. Then there's a seeking of a 97406 or on appeal that it's ineffective assistance of counsel. Can't the defendant make that argument?
He can in a direct appeal context where it's been recognized that there is a right to appellate counsel on direct appeal, and therefore ineffective assistance can be entertained for that counsel's performance. However, my understanding is that on a 97406 motion, even if the defendant chooses to retain counsel and that counsel does a bad job, there is no ineffective assistance of counsel claim that will rest because there is no antecedent right to counsel for that proceeding. The other thing, though, that I just before I forget real quickly that this brings up is on a 97406 appeal, suppose the defendant does have a counsel for 97406 without the right to it, and then that and loses, and then that attorney promises to do an appeal of the 97406 order. If there's going to be a right to counsel in this scenario to do it because he has counsel, I mean, it would seem that then you're going to start extending it, or there's a concern of extending it to that, too. Are we going to recognize a limited right to timely file an appeal from a 97406 order denying relief? So I just think there's a can of worms that you open up once you start recognizing a statutory right to counsel. And again, I guess I would caution the court to think to not do so, with the caveat that I'd be, again, happy to supplement on the issue of the extended supervision, which I apologize again. I didn't appreciate the distinction of the two-step court process. Again, I'm hopeful, though, that that would not change our position, but I'd like the opportunity at least to address it.
Can we decide this case then on the narrow response, the narrow question presented by the certification, which is when an attorney promises, blah, 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 and your concession that these two might be entitled to equitable relief? Can this case be decided on that without getting into the right to an attorney and extended supervision implications and all this other stuff? Or do we necessarily have to get, not necessarily into extended supervision, but to the right to the attorney before we address this equitable stuff?
I don't think you have to, but again, without looking at exactly what I mean, the second part of the truth in sentencing, where you go back to court for the court to decide how much more time you're going to serve, I suppose the same argument could be made that even though now it's a court that's doing it rather than the agency determining how much you're going to lose and how much you have to serve, that the same considerations apply, that we're really talking about a limited form of review, and that the court, and I may be wrong about what the court does in the extended supervision, but it may be that they're just looking solely at how much time is going to be involved. So that there isn't the other concerns that the agency normally looks at on cert review are also going to be present with respect to the extended supervision judicial review, the revocation, so that the only difference is that you have a court rather than the agency talking about the time frame. So that would suggest to me that maybe there aren't anything significantly different about the policy or reasons for not recognizing a statutory right to counsel, even in that venue. But again, and to answer your question, I think, and I hope the court could reach it without having to consider that with that explanation, I guess, is
the fact that there are three procedures, probation, parole, and extended supervision. The fact that the legislature has lumped two out of the three in one provision and the other one separately, the fact that they're lumped doesn't not necessarily mean that they are interpreted the same when they are different procedures.
True.
And regardless of what we say here, and I agree that counsel will then use that, whatever we say, as a jumping point, if there's a difference in the procedure, then the statute may have to be interpreted differently.
True.
Or a different procedure.
True.
Oh, your answer to
I just wish I had, you know, had it there so that I could tell you how I think about that, but
I don't know why you should feel badly, because it's not before us.
True.
Standards. So we'll be reluctant, it seems to me, to rule on it. Neither you nor the defendant has an interest in that at the moment, but it'll come.
True. Probably.
If the court wants additional briefing, it will advise you promptly.
All right.
Okay?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Porter.
If there are no further questions, I will sit down. Thank you.
Eddie.
Thank you, Your Honor. There's just a few points that I'd like to follow up on.
Counsel, I beg your indulgence.
Sure.
Because I want you to do that. But let me tell you a problem I'm having with this case. It seems to me now that the essence of your argument is relying on the statutory authority found in 977. Yet in your brief in chief, you don't even reference that statute. In your reply brief, you reference that statute, but not at all in the way that it's now being argued, and you don't in any way. It's now being argued that there's meaning to probation revocation proceedings. You don't reference that language at all, so you mention it in passing on page 10, but in a different context. So your argument that there's statutory authority is new here in oral argument with regard to the 977 probation revocation proceedings language.
That is true, Justice Bradley, but that was in response to your question. I keep going back to Schmeltzer, which talks about the right to counsel. It says before any court. It wasn't limited on any circumstance. It says once you have, you know, once there's a right, there's a right. I mean, that's what I'm relying upon.
Well, I understood your statutory argument. That's what I'm talking about. Your statutory argument, at least as set forth, I think, on pages 35 and 36 of your brief in chief, was essentially relying on page 35 on H.A. 205 sub 3 and H.A. 205 sub 8, and then in the last paragraph, continuing on top of the next page, in essence, you are saying this is the guts of our argument, that there's statutory authority in those two code provisions.
And I guess the confusion, Justice Bradley, has to do with in the case, the underlying cases here, I am not aware of either a petitioner being awarded state public defender. I don't think either. I know Attorney Turan is not a public, and I don't know about Attorney White.
The record is apparently unclear whether appointed or retained. That's what your opposing counsel says. Do you contest that?
No, I don't, because I know Attorney Turan is not a public defender. He may have been appointed to step in and fill a void. I can't speak to Attorney Weichman. And that's why, you know, it wasn't an issue of the state public defender not undertaking a statutory duty given to them to give counsel. The question that you had asked me previously is, what right is there to say that you have the right to counsel further, you know, past the administrative stage, and that's where I'm relying on 977.05. But it keeps coming back to, and my point is, once you have the right to a lawyer, wherever that right is determined, there is nothing that clearly says, okay, now the right is stopping, because the state is saying, well, once the administrative side is done, that right ceases. But there's nothing that supports that position, because I can view the appellate process as all the way up to this court, and even theoretically
beyond this court. I mean, in essence, if there's an argument that somehow it's violates the Constitution, you could take it up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So again, neither of the petitioners that I represent had, as far as I can tell, a public defender or had someone appointed under 977-05. But I certainly think that that is an argument that they do have the right to counsel at all stages.
Could I ask you, Mr. Cade, when the administrative proceedings were completed in Cade's situation?
When they were completed? I believe they were both completed in 2001. I couldn't tell you the exact time frame. Maybe it was 2002.
But what I'm really getting at is that there were a number of amendments to 977 in the 2001 session of the legislature. And I thought the revocation proceedings, administrative proceedings, had been completed in 2000.
The administrative proceedings were completed for Mr. Glenn in 2000, and for Mr. Griffin, I believe they were also completed in, yes, December of 2000.
Do we know that in 2000 there were references to proceedings in the statute?
I do not know that answer, Justice Prosser.
Well, if there weren't references to proceedings in the statute in 2000, would that kind of pull the props out under your statutory reliance on 977?
If it said hearings rather than proceedings, yes, that would pull the proverbial rug from underneath me. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cady. Thank you, Mr. Frymuth, for your arguments on Mentec 3, the 01-2345-02-1320, State Exwell Griffin and State Exwell Michael Glenn versus Smith and Litcher. The hearing is now closed.